Radio.
Making Sense of Marriage, the alternate Q&A session with Patrick Langrell at the Australian Catholic Youth Festival 2015, held in the Adelaide Convention Centre.
Sorry, I don't know if it's just me and I'm just dazed out or something, but just the third part where you're talking about society needs a mum and a dad, is that what you said?
Yes, yeah.
But could you please expand a bit more on that, just through some examples or something? I don't know.
Sure. So the general point was, I said the three-part point idea, the idea that sex makes babies, society needs babies, and babies need a mum and a dad. And a very sort of thin point, if we don't have any more babies, is what's experienced in some parts of the world with a very low fertility rate. They're facing great issues of actually being around in a few generations from now. Some parts of Europe have fertility rates so low that the idea of an aunt or an uncle, right, which we'll all be if we have brothers and sisters one day when we get older, it's just non-existent. Soon, people will not know the concept of aunts and uncles because they're not having more than one or two children. In most cases, not more than one or even less. So that's sort of a very elementary point about it. That's one of the sort of societal interests in why marriage is connected with making sure that there's a healthy way of bringing kids into the world. It's not the reason primarily many of us may get married, but it's one of the reasons why marriage arose as an institution, right? Not as an institution like a building, like the educational institution is located on such and such street, right? It's as a way of life, as a way of transmitting norms and cultural values that encourage people to commit together for the sake of their relationship and for any kids that they bring into the world, for the sake of raising a healthy generation of new people, you know? Yeah. Yes, question over here.
So the first view was about men and women, like how they bring about a family and kids. But I've heard like people who were for same-sex marriage argue that infertile couples can get married and they're both men and women. And it's not like they can have kids as well. Like they can't go towards the direction of a family.
Yeah.
So how would you argue against that? Like what do you think of that?
Yeah, sure. And that's a very good question. So everyone here, it's about the idea of infertile couples, if some people can't conceive, and why are they still allowed to get married? You know, if same-sex couples are also, you know, infertile in that sense or in some similar sense, and why can't they be married? No, it's a very good question. I think there's a view that I want to sort of avoid, which sees marriage as all about making babies, right? It's all about kids. That's not the view that we've inherited about the traditional view. It's one that sees marriage as a relationship that is fulfilling in its own right, but one that is always sort of also directed towards children. With the case of infertility, it's extremely rare that both couples in the relationship are infertile. Usually it's one or the other. And with infertility, sometimes that can be treated, so it can be fixed. In other cases, many infertile couples also look towards adopting kids, right? And when they do adopt kids, they'll be able to give their children the ideal of having a mother and a father. But I think another thing as well to note is that the experience and the hardship of infertility, which is a real hardship experienced by some married couples, points, I think, to the idea that they recognise that their marriage should be about bringing kids into the world, and that something that is natural and normal has been impeded in some way. And that's experienced as a real difficulty. And so I think that just further reinforces the link, the idea that there is something about their relationship which should be fulfilled, which is being lacked at the moment. That sort of experience of a lack or a missing out is not experienced with same-sex couples. You know, there's no sense in which two men or two women of their own, their relationship is lacking were it not to be fulfilled by a child, right? So the cases are actually quite different, and I think the infertility thing is actually a strong reason why we just know that relationships between men and women are often fulfilled in family life by having kids. Any other question? Yeah.
Sorry, just to say that I'm against the gay marriage because God created for man and woman to get married to have children, not man and man or woman and woman. Woman, if I'm true, what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that view is held by Catholics, Christians, many different religious communities. It was held long before any particular religious community or connection. It was held by ancient Greece, Mahatma Gandhi, many other figures from religious and non-religious communities hold this view. And when I was on my way here yesterday afternoon by taxi, I was chatting to the taxi driver about the conference, and he asked me what I was speaking on. And I asked him, I said, I'm speaking on the same-sex marriage issue. And he goes, oh, really interesting. He goes, well, what do you think on it? He goes, well, I believe marriage is just between a man and a woman. And I said, do you hold that because of religious views? And he goes, well, I'm a Sikh, but no, I don't. I hold it because I think it's just natural and it's the way kids should grow up in the world. And he didn't hold that for any particular religious view. And so I think many of us will hold this because we're brought up Catholic and we're brought up to understand the things. But one of the beautiful things about the Catholic faith is that we can understand things by faith, by revelation, by what we're taught by our elders and by our priests and bishops. And then we can also use our minds to think about these things. And my talk today was an exercise of just using our own mind and our own experience to try and understand the truths about the human condition. That's the beautiful thing about the Catholic faith, is there's such harmony between the truths of what we can know by reason and what we can understand by faith. Yeah?
I suppose my question would be, one of the arguments on the other side is that, well, homosexual couples can adopt kids anyway, so what would marriage change? What are the difference in laws that would change if homosexual marriage came about with adopting children? Like, what are the sort of differences there? So I could know how to respond.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's certainly the case that same-sex couples and other family arrangements have been raising kids in all different variety of circumstances throughout time. So I think one thing to realise as a general matter before we get to the particular legal one is that just the fact that people are raising children in some setting is no argument for therefore that the parents or the people raising the children should be married. There's a good argument to say that wherever any kids are being raised, they should be given as much support as possible, legal support and different arrangements to help them. But just the fact that the parents are or the people who are looking after kids are not married is no argument necessarily for them to be married. I mean, convents may raise a child or someone may have a child brought to them on a doorstep or this sort of thing, but we never go just from the fact that there are kids in a relationship. Otherwise, then, you know, even polyamorous households in the States or other places would be saying, as they are right now, that we should be offering marriage benefits to those who aren't, for their children, for the same sorts of reasons. When it comes to the particular laws, I'm not fully aware over the situation here exactly. Someone might be more well-versed over that than me. But I think what happens quite quickly after, for all the efforts that those people in the same-sex lobby go to create any link between marriage and kids, and that's part of the argument that often happens. There's no way in which marriage is connected with kids. It's totally about the romantic couple. I think it would be very quickly followed that if same-sex marriage came into law, so too would access, and not just access to, but encouragement of bringing kids into the world through artificial reproductive technologies and surrogate wombs and things like this, to encourage same-sex couples to be able to bring kids in all these situations. And I think the worry about this, not just the worry about the ethics of those different situations, is that what that means is that we're creating a world where we're bringing children into existence whom we know will not have any contact either with their mother or their father from the very beginning. And I think that's a real injustice done to kids. We're saying we're going to bring them up with no contact with the mother or the father. And I think that's a sort of a worrying trend. Yes.
Yeah. Hi. Let me start off by saying that I am a very devout Catholic. I go to church every Sunday. I'm very disciplined. I've never been drunk, never smoked before. Start my day in prayer, end my day in prayer. But I feel like the way that we've approached this issue in particular has sort of needs a bit more understanding and a bit more insight. And I'm not sure if we're being as honest as we should be as well. I'll start off by addressing a few of the points that you did make. We'll start off with the idea that marriage has traditionally always been this institution between a man and a woman. Now, we can go into other cultures, we can go into other religions, and we can see that this is not the case, but we don't even have to go that far. We can look into our own Bible to see how marriage has been shaped and structured by society. We see very prominent figures in Christianity, people like King Solomon, practicing polygamy, and it wasn't necessarily, well, it wasn't an issue to God because these were some of his favorite people. And so we can see that marriage has always been a cultural phenomenon in that sense. So it's not always, so this idea that marriage has always been this institution between a man and a woman isn't necessarily the case, because it has been shaped by society right throughout time, right throughout different cultures. And even today, in say, as you mentioned earlier, in certain Amish communities, not Amish communities, but certain communities in the US, certain Arabic communities, polygamy is still practiced today. So we can see that marriage is something that is, in many ways, a social construct. Let's
Well, how about I just respond to that first?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's certainly the case that marriage has taken on different adaptations and variations in many different cultures. In every culture, though, it was a sexual relationship. There's no evidence of any culture conceiving marriage has got anything to do with, you know, anything else, with reading poetry to each other or committing to playing tennis with each other and with no one else for the rest of their lives, right?
Yep.
It was always the idea of that this was some sort of way of bridging the sexual divide, bridging people's divide, so that they entered not into something that was purely temporary and just themselves, but was sort of transcendent in a way. And different religions have different sort of mystical ways of expressing this. But it was always about bridging the sexual divide. What's bridging the sexual divide? The great sexual divide is not in terms of attractions, same sex or opposite sex type attraction. The sexual divide is between men and women.
Yeah.
Right? So it was always about that. Now, why was it always about that? Because people know what happens when people bridge the sexual divide in relationships, right? Kids are brought into the world, right? So polygamy is certainly, you know, occurrence, and there are many things that happen in the Bible, but just something happening in the Bible isn't evidence against marriage in one way or the other.
Of course, yeah.
Right, so marriage has always been, all these different cultures, about bringing the embodiment of the male and the female together and what that brings into the world,
yeah,
and a way of keeping those things together. So I think just the small variations in cultural differences doesn't do anything to the idea of marriage as an institution aimed at identifying and finding ways of looking after that particular need. And I think that that's not challenged by anything that you said, I don't think.
I can agree with that, but do you also see that marriage itself has been shaped and changed in various forms by culture? So say, for instance, at the heart of it, I can agree that it is primarily a means of bridging the sexual divide. But on the other hand, it is something that has been changed and shaped by culture. So say, if polygamy was something that was accepted back in the day and now it's sort of frowned upon, then why can't it be moved into something else today if that's what society deems necessary?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't disagree with you there that people's understanding of marriage has been changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, my remarks were based on the idea that there's two views of marriage. What I didn't explain was how the second view came about. But the second view came about because of precisely those sorts of changes in people's perceptions of marriage. You know, how did that second view, that sort of romantic soulmate view, arise? Well, it's not too hard when you think about it. You know, I mean, the 60s... sexual revolution, the idea that we need to be free of norms and rules and things that oppress us. Love is love. We should be free to whom we love. You know, around that sentence of time, you had the onset of contraception, right? Yes. Which separated the sex making from the baby making, right? So it'd be possible to engage in sexual relationships with a lesser chance of conceiving. So the link all of a sudden between people's understandings of relationships, sex and marriage and kids was severed by that. And then soon after that, you had the rise, not just of divorce, which was before that available if you could prove that either there was abuse, adultery or abandonment, what they called fault divorce, right? That was then removed with a thing called no fault divorce. So you didn't have to prove that your spouse was either, you know, unfaithful or was abusive. You could just cut it off for no reason whatsoever. That was called no fault divorce, or then unilateral no fault divorce, meaning one side or the other could just break the contract. All of a sudden the marriage is no longer permanent, right? So from all of a sudden that understanding, marriage became much less about for life and much more sort of what's convenient for me, and if the relationship's not working for me, then it's out. And then soon after that, around that time a little bit later, you had the rise of assisted reproductive technologies, where people largely then start to say, well, I can, you know, I don't need a, who needs a man? There's a feminist slogan, you need a man like, you know, fish needs a bicycle type thing. You know, I can make babies on my own. So all of a sudden you have this idea that, well, we can create life without engaging in lovemaking. So life making can happen without lovemaking. So through all these sort of chips, just in the last 30 years, what you're saying is that change does happen. I'm saying, yes, it has. Now, what we've got to do is think, are those changes good? Have those changes helped people's marriages become stronger? Have mothers and fathers stuck together? Have their kids been happier? And I think the social science statistics over the last 30 years and our own sort of experience and knowledge of other family life has been that it's been a tremendous strain on marriages. People are marrying for much less, you know, much less often. They're marrying for not as long time. Young people are delaying marriedhood to later years. They're getting more skeptical about whether it's possible to be in long-term committed relationships. So I think this sort of historical change, which I classified as the sort of romantic soulmate view of marriage, which seems very fun and sort of exciting, is one of the reasons why marriage culture is in such decline now. And so what we've got to think is, okay, well, enshrining same-sex marriage into law and saying it's no longer got anything to do with bringing up kids with mum and dad, it's much more about the emotional intimacy of the couple going ahead, is that going to be a good thing for our marriage culture? And I'm not sure it is.
Yep.
So while I acknowledge historical change, I don't think it's, you know, set that it has to go that way. It means we have to think seriously about those sorts of changes and ask whether they're good changes.
Yep.
Mike, we might just go to another question at the back, and if you have some more thoughts, again later. Yeah. Question at the back? Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your insights today. As you point out over and over again, marriage and family as a quite deep and strong bond. In fact, children play an important role. So I'm wondering, there's been, you know, the summit on family and all that and lots of talks on marriage. Has anyone in your experience ever spoken to the kids? Because I do know a lot of children who grew up without, this is referring to your third part where a child needs a mum and a dad. And those two roles are important in a child's life. But many and many, many kids are now this day and age growing up without both sets of parents. In all of these discussions, I haven't come across anyone who's spoken or any children who've come up and say what they need to say or what they want to say. Hmm. Have you heard of anything?
Yeah, I have. It's a difficult issue. I mean, we all know it's a difficult issue to talk about generally, the same-sex marriage one. And that's partly because the other side has done so well to convince everyone else, and sometimes even us, that any discussion about, you know, family structure or parenting or things like this, if you express any view, it's being hateful, being demeaning. And I think that sort of culture makes it very difficult for us to generally talk about it. I also think it makes it particularly difficult for children either of same-sex households or for children who've been raised in very difficult environments to feel that they can express or air what they really think about their situation without feeling, you know, sort of shunned out or silenced. There have been a number of children of same-sex couples who have spoken up about their experience of living in a same-sex household, and that experience has also tracked what the social science, at least the serious and credible social science, has looked at the outcomes for children who've been raised in same-sex households over a long term. Some people that come to mind include Katie Faust, who is an American who was actually out in Australia a few months ago, who's raised by her mother and her mother's lesbian partner. And she says she loves her parents very much. She loves her mum and her mum's partner very dearly. But she really missed ever knowing her dad. And she felt that being raised in a household where she was never able to know who her father was made her question things like, you know, why wasn't he around? Why was my father not there? I wonder who he is. I wonder what he's like. And that sort of experience is very, very similar to the experience of kids who've been brought into the world through artificial reproduction as well. And many of them have also wondered who my dad is. You know, you sometimes see little T-shirts that you see little babies where my daddy's name is Donor. You know, sort of a joke on the idea that you know, you really need to know who your dad is. But a lot of the kids in those situations have been wondering about what life would have been like with my father, and why did he leave me, and why was there money involved in my coming into the world, and so there are lots of. There are lots of people who've expressed some of those concerns. So Katie Faust is one. Doug Mainwaring is another. Robert Oscar Lopez, a Latino bisexual in California, has also written publicly about his experience growing up in a same-sex household. Heather Barwick. A lot of these people have written essays describing their experience, all of them loving their parents and those who raise them, but expressing the sort of existential angst that came with feeling like they were deprived of knowing either their mother or their father, and then they were told that that feeling that they're having is wrong for them to have, that they should be celebrating the diversity in their family lifestyle. And so a lot of people in those situations, I think, are sort of silenced out of the fear of what might happen if they go contrary to the, you know, the storyline of how there's no differences and the kids are just fine. And so I think it is something that needs to be looked into more, and just more really good social science done on this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lastly, sorry, can you recommend a site or some studies we could look into? Because I think most of us will sometime in our life need to vote on policymakers' decisions.
Sure. On the marriage issue in general or on the social science?
Social science.
Sure. So the best social science and studies that you could look up would be the work done by Mark Regneris, who did the National Family Structures Study in the United States, about 3,000 family households that were looked at. There's also Donald Paul Sullins from the Catholic University of America, who's conducted a couple of studies in the last few months, Donald Paul Sullins. And then Paul Amato, who conducted a review of the 59 studies produced by the American Psychological Association that said there was no differences between kids raised in same-sex households and kids raised by their mother and father. So Paul Amato, who looked at all of those studies that said there were no differences and said that basically they couldn't prove their point because the sample sizes were so small and the methodology used was so flawed that it couldn't actually prove what it did. So Mark Regneris examined a large-scale, longitudinal, over time, looked at kids as they progressed over about 10 years. So that those sort of three sources would be the best. In terms of understanding the issue in general, I think a really good book, especially if you understand both sides, because it's really important, this issue, that we understand not just what we believe, but what the best arguments that the other side has for their view as well. And I think that's just a matter of fairness when we're discussing the issue with people. There's a book by Maggie Gallagher and John Corvino called Debating Same-Sex Marriage, and both of them take different views, Maggie Gallagher defending the traditional view and John Corvino defending the same-sex marriage view. So that's a good one. And then another one by David Blankenhorn on the future of marriage is another good one. Or another good one would be anything by Ryan Anderson, Sharif Gerges, and Robert George. I think they've got one, What is Marriage? Good books. And then there's a number of public lectures given by the Archbishop of Sydney, and they're all excellent. So you should type in Archbishop Anthony Fisher, same-sex marriage, and you'll see a bunch of those. That was all I was going to say about that. Any other? Yes, got a question here. Yeah.
It was more of a comment. Just about Archbishop Julian Porteous and everything that was going on in Tasmania towards the booklet in the Catholic schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think just wondering about, well, do you know much about it? Do you know much about, I suppose I feel like I only really know what was published in the media, and even in Catholic media I felt like there's only a certain amount of truth that we get. So I suppose, one, do you know much more about that? Can you shed some more light on it and how far it's progressed, and what more as young Catholics can we do to support the church and support our leaders, support people who are speaking publicly out on these topics, how to support them, what can we do, I suppose, other than the obvious in praying for them? Speak more about the topic. Do you know much about it and sure. what it's going to be like? And I suppose looking to the future, that we as a generation are going to grow up continually seeing these kinds of things happen, and what are your thoughts on it, I suppose?
Sure. Great question. Great series of good questions there. No, it's very good. I might start with the last and then work my way back. The future. I think it's going to be tough. We live in a time where, when it comes to this particular issue, so many people are doing everything they can to make our view look like it can only be motivated by hatred of gay people. It's bigoted, it's outdated. You would have heard the idea that we're on the wrong side of history, move out of the way, watch out. I think it's important to call out these things for what they are. They're tactics of intimidation, right? They're basically like schoolyard bullies. That's what you do. When you want to sort of shut someone down, when you want to win an argument without making an argument, you name call. You say someone's a bigot, right? And when that happens, that can make us feel really, we don't want to say what we think, right? We can start to internalize those criticisms and start to think maybe just upon maybe there's something that's true about them. So the first thing we've got to realize is that it's not true, right? That what we believe is not only true and good, but that that's actually really what will make people happy. Even in a strange way, even for those who think that they want to be married to people of the same sex, right? And so to the extent that we, you know, when it comes to our beliefs, our moral beliefs on sexuality, sex, and marriage, you know, it often seems like the church is always, our faith is always telling us no to things, no to this, no to that, right? But the more we come to understand the issue by reading, you know, talking to others, going to things like this, we understand that the church only ever says no to something only when it's affirming an even greater yes, right? And an even greater positive vision of what marriage is life like, what relationships can really be about, and where happiness truly lies. So the first thing we've got to do is become absolutely convinced that this view is not harmful of people or hurtful in any way, but is ennobling and inspiring, and it can actually help us live really, really happy lives. That's important. That's one thing that we can do for ourselves. Another thing is, I think we've got to learn how to be able to talk about issues that are complex with people without either side name-calling or getting frustrated or just sort of shutting things down. I mean, this is just one issue, but in the future, there's going to be lots of controversial issues that come up, whether same-sex marriage is passed or not. It's not going to stop there. There's going to be lots of other things we're going to have. And if we've got to learn how to live in a society where we can talk with people whom we disagree civilly and in friendship. And I think the current attempts, like the one in Tasmania, to sort of shut down conversation from the get-go, to say, well, no, even if you're a Catholic bishop, you can't even preach basic Catholic doctrine to Catholic students at a Catholic high school. Right? If we're not even going to allow that, then that doesn't put us in a very good situation for basically just living with people with whom we disagree. Right? So I think society is at a real juncture over things like that particular case and other examples, which just shows how polarized things can get and how fragmented society can become if we can't learn to talk about issues with people. So I think we've got to try and model ourselves examples of civic discourse, civic discussion that sort of show the way how others can engage in those sorts of debates. And I think that'll be important for the future too. And then how can we actually help? Well, by learning to speak about this issue with our friends, you know, reading up on it, reading a few books on it. I think that our extent of our fear and intimidation lessens the more we know about the issue. Right? The more you try and understand the issues of same-sex marriage and maybe just the idea of what marriage is and why it's all been around and what's it for, then our sense of intimidation or being scared at challenging questions actually decreases. So I think a good way to do that is to read a bit more and then to try it out with friends, probably friends first who, you know, agree with what you believe and see what they think. And then just talk about it casually with people who don't disagree and try and understand, well, why do you hold that view? Okay, and how does that, what do you think about this and that? And then from there you grow a little bit bigger. And we just need to all be comfortable at learning how to speak about these things. Now, I'm not saying that means we all need to be public speakers. We don't. But we all at least need to do some elementary work in understanding the issue and then learning how to share it with our friends and then broaden out from there.
A good book that I've nearly finished reading is by Christopher West, The Good News About Sex and Marriage.
Yeah.
It has a good understanding of everything from Genesis to all that stuff about theology of the body and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he answers a lot of those questions. That if sex in general just becomes a self-gratifying act, it's kind of a pointless thing, and that's where it's sort of coming towards.
Yeah.
Instead of being as a gift to each other, is the way God planned it. But that book I recommend to read. It has good knowledge, like what you're saying, to help with like the argument stage.
Yeah.
So you have a good understanding.
Yeah, it's a great book. The Good News About Sex and Marriage. It's a series of questions and answers on everything from marriage to dating, chastity. Very similar to the sort of stuff that you would have heard in Jason Evett's talk if you've been to any of his material. But no, you're right. I mean, we live in a time where people, the sort of general philosophy of romantic sexual lives is, you know, if it feels good, do it. And if that's the way you're inclined, then go ahead and do it. Whereas, yeah. So that's the reason why we try and inform ourselves and educate ourselves, because we soon realize as we mature that part of life, well, part of maturing in life and growing up and also being happy is not just giving in to whatever we feel like doing, but learning how to bring our feelings, whatever they are, and our attractions under the control of what we really want to do with our lives and where we really want to go and make sure that our sexual desires and interests really serve our overall happiness. And that means not just giving in or just sort of going with whatever we think or feel at one particular point is the right thing, but learning how to master them, how to have strengths in our life that mean when we go into our relationships, we're really in control, not just sort of slaves to our bodies in some way. Yeah, and you touched on it by saying the idea was self-gift, self-donation. It's the idea, so you can really give yourself to another in marriage. Any other questions, thoughts? Yeah, question here.
G'day. You spoke before about the need for a mum and a dad. What are the particular qualities that a mum and a dad bring to family life?
That's a great question. The question was about mums and fathers and what mothers and fathers do. We know there's been some really interesting studies that try and look at and observe the different things that mothers and fathers bring to, or whether there's any sort of sex-specific benefits that mums and dads bring to marriage. Now, that thing is obviously denied by the whole same-sex marriage movement. There's nothing unique about mothers and fathers. They're essentially replaceable. Parenting is sort of androgynous. It can be done by anyone. But some of the things that some psychologists have done, that when it comes to mothers, it particularly comes to things like, three things stand out, I think, to me and to some of the social science work. Women's capacity to breastfeed, women's capacity to read and emotionally understand where their children are at, and also their capacity to nurture. And now, obviously, breastfeeding is something men can't do. So that particular one is, for most women, they would describe that as both as physically pleasurable and emotionally a way of building a closer relationship with the children. There's also a lot of science that goes to show that breastfeeding has great health benefits both for the mother, also as well for the child. Things which just aren't there if you're just giving your child sort of, you know, baby formulas type thing. Also, when it comes to reading children, mothers are much better when it comes to distinguishing the cries of an infant as to whether those are cries of hunger or cries of tiredness or pain. Men will just often be, oh, the child's crying, what do we do? They don't really know what to do, right? So there's this sort of quality of being able to emotionally read the children much better. Even when it comes to times of tension or concern, mothers are much better at being able to read what's the cause or investigate or at least go looking. And that then slides into the idea of, as well as being caretakers, that women are primed both biologically and physiologically with an early age with the child to bond particularly very quickly and to be very nurturing from a young age of the child. That's different to men. Men, typically fathers, their main areas of impact in parenting would come to things like play and challenging the children into sort of independence. You know, if I'm not going to tell you who's, whether it's the mother or the father doing this, who's likely to be throwing the child very high up in the air or rumbling and tumbling all over the ground, right? We sort of laugh because it's pretty obvious. We know who it's going to be, right? The wife's probably going to be like, oh my gosh, you know, don't throw so high, right? So the father's typically often there doing rough and tumble play. And that might seem just like, oh, that's just some sort of social construct of men, they do that. But no, the good thing about that is what that actually teaches children from a young age is how to channel physical activity and aggression in some way through knowing that things like kicking and biting and slapping is wrong, right? And it's typically often the men who are sort of, from a very young age, putting that sort of pressure on kids to know what's right. The men are also, fathers tend to also be a lot more thinking of the long-term development of the children rather than the immediate short-term development that typically women and mothers are. We'll look at the immediate situation of what the child is going through, how they are. The men are typically thinking a bit further ahead in advance, sort of thinking, okay, now you've got to challenge yourself. What are you going to do? How are you going to sort of grow up? You know, we've got to do this for that. And they're also a little bit less adaptive at knowing how things are going on right at the moment. So those sorts of things, you know, sort of we all sort of know them intuitively a little bit from our own family life, but have generally been thought to be some sort of sex-specific benefits of both having a mother and father. And that you see that kids who grow up in families without either the mother or the father in experience difficulties in different ways, whether it's the mother or the father, and also whether it's a son or a daughter as well, specifically. So there's differences from both the presences of and the absences of both mother and father that also reinforce the idea that parenting isn't just some general term, but there are some, you know, it's just mothering and fathering are basically the ways of which kids grow up, and also changes the way both mothers and fathers are themselves. And everyone knows that men who are married and do marriage well spend less time at the bars and the pubs and more time at home with family. Men often make a lot more money and they live a lot longer, surprisingly. Do you know how much, how many years off life you lose if you smoke a pack a week? 10 years. You know how many years you gain if you're married and you're faithful if you're a man? 10 years. You gain 10 years. So the lesson to learn from this, if you smoke, get married, basically. It sort of balances each other out. But yeah, so those are some of the thoughts about mothering and fathering. Yeah?
Can I just add one more to yours? Is actually the genetics themselves, you find that as children go into adolescence and they're trying to work out why they're thinking a certain way or acting a certain way, they look to their family trees. Oh, my uncle's like this, or my aunt's like this, or my mum or my grandparents. It actually gives them some closure. If they have no possibility of finding that genetic tree, it's just another hurdle in adolescence, which, let's face it, is hard enough.
Yeah, that's right. And that's part of the idea of identity. You know, we're not just sort of single, solo persons, just, you know, conceived in a sort of matrix-like bubble, you know, where we're all thousands of us lined up. We all have histories, you know, we all belong to families, and those families have families before them, and they have names, and, you know, so all of that, that shapes us in fascinatingly, you know, mysterious ways, some of which we try and figure out, and we find it kind of funny when we realize, oh, I have curly hair, that's from my grandfather, you know, blah, 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 something like that. But so there's sort of interesting ways where that works, but it's certainly the case that that's the experience of the human experience of which marriage is at the very center of bringing about and making happen. We have a few more questions, one here and then a couple up the back. Yeah.
You were saying about the traits that the men and the women bring to a family, but what actually happens to the kid if they don't have a mother or a father?
It's a good question. So typically in when it comes to the absence of parents, typically it's more likely that father absence is more common than much more than mothers being absent. And that's obvious in a very, you know, obvious way. When a baby is born, there's generally bound to be a mother somewhere nearby. But whether there's a father nearby is an open question. And that's it's only a culture that encourages husbands and wives, fathers and mothers to stick together, that the father is there. So a lot of these things, it's the case that that father absence is a big social problem, which before the same-sex marriage debate was the big thing in marriage sort of studies and scholarship that looked at what the effects were on kids of not growing up with the father. Now, obviously, it goes to say, whenever you're talking about social science stuff, that it works in generalities. So it's saying, look, generally speaking, these are some of the things that happen, whereas all of us may know someone who's grown up without a father and they've turned out just fine, and their mother's done, you know, incredibly good work, and they've been very blessed. But generally it's been the case that when the fathers have been absent, some of the effects on men have been that they've experienced high rates of aggression, they're more likely to commit crime, more likely to drop out of school than if they have their father present. For the women, it's been that they've more likely to have been sexually active and also sexually active at a younger age. It tends, interestingly enough, to be the case that when a father is present in the household, a biological father, that even women will hit puberty later, so it would be delayed rather than it would come earlier if there's no father in the house or if there's a stepfather in the house as well, too. It has the same effect if there's no father. So some of those things are quite, you know, worrying, and that's what most of the people who are in the same-sex marriage, you know, debate scheme today were for 30 years prior to that working to do everything they can to try and keep families together, to keep husbands and wives together, because that's where they saw the real breakdown was. And that's sort of just been completely forgotten now that the whole same-sex marriage issue is the thing. No one's worried about that. And you can't talk about what damages it would be without a father, because that would then mean that, you know, two mums would be, you know, you'd see those sorts of things happen there because they don't have a father in the relationship. So that whole issue has been sidestepped for the much more controversial and seemingly, you know, nothing wrong with it gay marriage picture. But I think you'll see, and some of the social science has said, that the same problems exist there in households without without a father. So those are just some of the things.
I'm after some parenting advice.
Please, here you go.
I've got a 6-year-old daughter and little Molly, and she goes to a Catholic school on the northern beaches of Sydney. Loved her first year. She has a little corner of the of her bedroom where she prays every night, so she's really embraced the Catholicity of the school. So one day, though, she came home from school and said two girls in her class are going to go to a different country and get married, two of her friends, because they weren't allowed to get married in Australia. And she's got this information from a birthday party that she'd gone to. A same-sex couple and their child had obviously passed this information on to the two girls in Molly's class. So I'm just wondering, you know, it was quite... I'm not often lost for words, but she came home from school and she was she mentioned this situation, that the two girls were going off to get married. I'm just wondering, have you got any advice, just to sum up what you're saying in 30 seconds in a simple way? I can you know, pass that message on to my daughter.
Sure. Well, it's a very good question. I think, you know, the simplest way to try and understand this, I mean, it's difficult when, if your daughter's 6 years old and she hasn't had other conversations about how she or others came into the world, it's going to be hard to try and get some of this across to it, get some of this across to her. So in essence, some of these conversations could be had a little bit now, but then probably explored a little bit more later when she's a bit older and can understand some of it. But I think generally, you can say that something similar to what I said before, that marriage is about bringing men and women together to be husbands and wives, and then fathers and mothers to any kids that their love brings into the world. Right? So marriage is about bringing men and women together as husbands and wives to be father and mother to any children that their love brings into the world. So it's not just about who you love. You know, marriage is about, oh, I love this person, therefore get married. I mean, if these two little girls love each other, they probably are very good friends, right? And so I think we should be encouraging people to be very good friends with people of the same sex and the opposite sex, right? So I think we've got to be able to distinguish and find some way of encouraging very good friendships with the opposite sex and with the same sex, but coming to understand that when it comes to romantic and sexual relationships, those things are really good and really precious because of the significance of what they can bring about, just whole new little people, little Jameses and Jamies. And so I think sort of encapsulating the idea that sex makes babies, society needs babies, and then babies need a mum and a dad is sort of the best way to sort of bring that about. But you can probably have those conversations and develop them deeper once, you know, once she gets a little bit older too.
Only a quick question, but I found talking to my students at school, they are most interested in the equality side of marriage. So for them, the equality is a big issue rather than marriage. So it's really hard to get them to actually start talking about what marriage is in the first place. And I think that your approach is fantastic, but it's kind of hard to get there, which is crazy, I know, but what do you say about that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. That's why I tried to... I think you've got to try and find different ways of explaining that there's two different ideas of what marriage is about. And if you hold one view of marriage, that is that marriage is about love and commitment, then equality there is going to work as an argument. It's got its full force. It's going to say, yep, then same-sex couples and everyone else should be equal because they are equal. They're equal in the sense that they can achieve those sorts of relationships just like everyone else, right? So it becomes very hard from that point onwards. But I think you've got a picture that there's a different idea of marriage and that we've got to sort of understand that. I tend to think, you know, all of us, and I would hope all of us here, are actually in favour of marriage equality, right? We all think every marriage should be treated equally. None of us think that, you know, any genuine marriage shouldn't be recognised, right? So we're all in favour of equality. So I think, yes, we're in favour of equality. But before we know what the law is going to apply equally, we've got to have some idea of what's being applied equally, right? And to do that, we've got to know what marriage is. So I think that's something that's got to be done first, because whatever the law will say, whether it says two people, same sex or opposite sex, can get married, it's going to draw some lines around that other relationships aren't marriages. So at the moment, if same-sex marriage passed and said marriage is between any two persons, then people in polyamorous relationships, three or four people, will still not be allowed to get married under that view. Now, they'll say, as they are now, marriage equality. I say our relationships are just as equal as their relationships, right? So then the same-sex people who don't want polyamorous marriage are going to say, well, no, because marriage is just between two people. And the polyamorous people are going to say, well, that's a violation of our equality. Well, why is marriage just between two people? And then they're going to say, well, it just is, right? Sort of with no reason. But that's the same reason why we say marriage is between a man and a woman. So I think there's a few issues there. But the equality thing is a difficult one to get because, well, not just because it's sort of a conceptual argument, but if you say that you're in favour of equality, it's very emotional. So if you can make your side look like the side of equality, then that's a very strong case. But, you know, I think that those are some of the issues. I mean, it's got to also be said that we are all equal in the most important and fundamental respect, and that's that we're all equal in dignity. Whether we're in a relationship or not, whether we're same-sex attracted or not, all of us are unique, unrepeatable, beautiful men and women. And that's the most important equality that we've got to keep at recognition of. You know, whether we're in a relationship or not doesn't change that. And I think that's important to say as well. One question up the back and then another one here, then another one here.
I just wanted to share a personal thing that we experienced, was that the attack on marriage isn't just on marriage, it's also on friendship. And you saying to that couple before that it's okay to have friends, I just wanted to share that in the secular world, like when me and my friend are together, people would assume that we're together as a lesbian couple. And we often like shared how we feel like the attack on marriage is also on friendship, because it's like the enemy doesn't want you to have a friendship. Otherwise, oh, it means that you're gay or a lesbian. And it sort of confirms that, yeah, it's not just attack on marriage, it's also on like your relationship with people in general.
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. You're completely right. I think it is. And it makes sense, right? Because what are friendships? Friendships are deep, strong, emotional commitments to someone other. And the good, they're good. And they're good for you, right? The friendship, that's what friendship is, when you want the best for someone and they want the best for you. Now, people who take this particular view of marriage, the romantic view of marriage, hold pretty much that's what marriage is, except just with your number one, the person who you have most love and commitment to, the person who you have your most emotional feelings. So upon this view of marriage, there's nothing distinctive about marriage from friendship, other than that it's sort of friendship ramped up. It's your number one best friend. In fact, that's the exact phrase used to describe marriage by one of the biggest same-sex marriage advocates in the States, John Corvino from Wayne State University. He says, marriage is your number one friendship, right? Well, under that view, it just blurs the boundary between marriage and friendships. And so it means that you, as great, good friends of each other, some people start to assume in this new culture where marriage is just about your strongest emotional friendships, they won't really know the differences between it. And that's the point where the whole issue becomes just superfluous. Why we then have marriage law? And what's the point of the government being involved telling who's your best friend from the other? Right? It just doesn't make sense. Like the government doesn't care what you two are up to later tonight, whether you're going to go watch a movie or eat at some restaurant or another. Like, they've got no interest in that. So why would that sort of relationship need to be recognized and legally regulated and of an interest of public policy? And you know, so I think you're right. There was a great article by Anthony Esselin about in 1995 called A Requiem of Friendship. the end of friendship. And he talked about how this sort of move brings about and makes it look, you know, gay or lesbian for people to be really good friends of each other. And I think that makes it difficult because in a culture where, particularly with men, if you have a close guy friend, like a really good friend, that's seen more so, I think, for men than it is for women. Oh, that's kind of weird. You're really good friends with another guy? How does that work? That's kind of gay, you know? And I think if you're feeling that in the case with women, who are typically much, much more likely to be good friends, you know, and walk around and even hold hands as friends without being romantically, you know, linked to each other, then that's even more of a worrying sign if that's the case. So I think in order to help build our marriage culture and our friend culture better, we've got to get better on both fronts.
And that was actually my point, is the policy making. How do we separate?
And feel free to kick me out or leave if you, I know there's lots of there's lots of other things going on.
How do we separate marriage from
Thank you.
Marriage between partners as to what's recognised by the state? Do we need state intervention? Shouldn't marriage be between people rather than having the state involved at all?
Yeah. Well, I think the reason why we have, you know, the state or government involved in it is because when it comes to a lot of these things, we don't just leave it up to ourselves or others to figure out what marriage is, you know, or how it all works. We often rely upon others, family, friends, wider social community, certain ways of value, of sort of Australian values, things like that, when it comes to learning how we live out good marriage lives. So the government doesn't control marriages, but it plays a helpful role in guiding people towards what a really good and sound vision of marriage is, right? And by enshrining things in law that it's for life and between men and women, then people themselves know from the law and from the culture that this is a good way of life, this is the way how marriage is lived, and I can receive the social and legal and financial and governmental support to try and live that out. I think if you get government out of the marriage business, which can always seem very tempting, especially with all the recent debates moving on in very scary ways, what that means is you're just sort of leaving it up to people to make up these things on their own. And that's a very hard thing for us to do. Often cases as well with family breakdown, a very difficult thing. The state's going to have to come in and try and fix up the broken pieces. When a couple decides to divorce, what happens to the child? The child just live on their own? So, it seems easy. I'll say, oh, look, we'll get the government out of the marriage business at the beginning and then that'll solve everything. But in reality, the government will have to come back in. There'll be increased rates of poverty, increased rates of fatherlessness, of, you know, so all that sort of stuff makes it a good reason to think why the government plays a helpful role providing a sound culture for married couples themselves to live out good marriages and families. So I think that's a helpful reason. Yeah?
What about that view where they're like, give gay couples what they want, like give them
the like sharing of assets and give them all this, but just don't call it marriage, like call it something else?
Yeah, so that was something that was tried a few years ago, the idea of civil unions, the idea that, you know, we can provide all of the tax, legal and financial benefits that marriage brings without calling it marriage, and hopefully that will work. I think that's sort of largely, the debate's moved on from there because it soon became realised that same-sex couples weren't after just having access to those certain things. They wanted marriage. They wanted the word marriage. They wanted the label because of the social approval and sense of, you know, dignity that they said that conferred upon their relationship. They were much less interested in all those other financial legal arrangements, which were already on offer and on the books, on laws, well before that was debated. So I think we've moved quite on from there.
Okay, I think at least probably half the room has already left, but thank you so much, Patrick, for talking about this big topic and sharing a lot of information and for also being so open-minded and understanding. So we have a small gift to give to you. So
thank you so much.
Thank you
very much. Thanks. Thanks,
everyone. That was Patrick Langrell with the alternate Q&A session for Making Sense of Marriage. This Q&A session is from the Australian Catholic Youth Festival 2015 and was recorded as a collaboration between XT3 and Cradio. And for more from the Australian Catholic Youth Festival, and for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.